All right. Old Testament survey. We are looking at the next three books in the Bible in just a moment on Joshua, Judges, and Ruth. If I remember, there should have been, yes, there are study questions for Exodus through Deuteronomy. Everybody should have completed. Let's go around the room. This is study questions for Exodus through Deuteronomy. It's the last page.
This is the last page.
Yes.
That's right.
Do you have that yet?
Well, I haven't got the notes.
So, no, you need the study questions, which is the last page.
I'm thoroughly stuffed now.
Yes, I know.
All right, let's see what we know. These are not your major exams yet. Don't worry. Number one, at least, Barry, you should be able to answer. Moses grows up where, but at the age... Oh, there should be a blank there of what? Flees the land of what?
40.
All right, the age of 40, he flees to the land of... Midian, exactly. It's page 33, the last page. Study questions for Exodus. You've got it there. All right. Okay, I don't know why that blank didn't come out.
So Moses grows up in Egypt and flees.
At the age of 40, flees the land of Midian. Number two, Jeremy. Moses lives the next blank years as a blank. This is a key. It's a conceptual question. So you're going to have to think. John?
40.
40 years he lives.
As a shepherd.
Yes, as a shepherd. Good, you have to remember that. Paul 3.
Moses and Aaron stand before Pharaoh to ask to... Let my people go.
Four answers, exactly. Number four, let's try to figure two purposes for the plagues. Oh, sorry, Geraldine.
Yeah. One would have been to show the Egyptians the power of God of the Hebrews.
Yes.
And the second then was, or a second one then would have been, to help their cause, that Pharaoh would release them from their captivity, from the slavery under the Egyptians.
You're right, but I'm looking for a word. You need one key word. I mean, how is it that God is going to bring about this deliverance? I'm not sure how to ask the question without getting the answer. The second purpose of the plague is to... You can either use the words humble or break the Egyptians.
Yeah,
it is to break them.
Right?
These are disasters. These are not little chastening swats on the back end. These are major disasters. They are meant to humble or break the Egyptians. What did you say?
To humble Pharaoh.
That's it. That's right.
And all of Egypt. I didn't say that.
That works.
And did you do the second one yet?
That's what we did. Yeah, she said
two.
There were two. The first one was... to show the Egyptians the power of the Hebrew God.
So there.
Number five, Nita, what happened at the Red Sea?
The sea split. Israel walked over on dry land, and the Egyptians followed and were drowned.
Well, that's concise and complete. Six, Barry, what did Israel eat in the wilderness? Blank and blank.
Manna and quail.
Mm-hmm. Quite a lot of it, too. Jeremy, at Mount what? The what was given and the what constructed?
Mount Zion.
At the what?
Mount Zion.
At Mount Zion?
The law was given.
Yes?
And the...
What was constructed? John, help him out.
The commandments.
No, the commandments were constructed. Something was built.
Tabernacle.
The tabernacle. There you go. Funny how a word will clean. Yes. At Mount Sinai, that's where they were given the directions on how to build the tabernacle. They didn't move until they had built it. There we go, John. The law was divided into three sections. They are?
Civil, ceremonial, and moral.
Exactly. Name three of the seven objects in the tabernacle from memory.
Golden candlestick, laver, showbread.
Table of showbread. Showbread was on the table. But that's all right. Geraldine, do you know the priests were chosen from which tribe?
Levites.
Yes. What was Moses' sin, Nita?
I didn't get that one. but I would say that his sin was not believing. I don't know what to call it, where he didn't think that he was, because he wanted his brother to do the speaking for him. And
no, that was not his sin. That was understandable. God worked with that.
Oh, in the wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, anger.
Anger.
Yeah.
It conquered him. Who was chosen to be the new leader after Moses, Barry?
Joshua.
Let's see if you can write the Ten Commandments in short form. Now, what's funny is, remember, in the Catholic Bible, there's a commandment missing, and the last commandment split into two. So you got to.
Which is cruel because you've learned the commandments.
You got to unlearn them. That's right. But see, this is all preparing you for the final. So take note.
Yeah.
Who wants to try first commandment? Jeremy.
You shouldn't have other gods.
Ahead of me, that's right. No other gods before me. Nothing before me. John, do you know what number two is?
Have no idol gods.
No idols, right? You will not make any graven images. Paul.
Not take the Lord's name in vain.
Okay. Geraldine.
Honor thy father and thy mother.
Okay, that's okay. It's out of order, but that's all right. Honor your parents. There's one that's Nita?
Keep the Sabbath.
Keep the Sabbath. Honor thy father and thy mother. Obey them. Mary?
Thou shalt not kill.
Thou shalt not kill. Jeremy? Thou shalt not covet. Okay. That's actually number 10, but that's right. That'll work. It's another one.
Thou shalt not steal.
Thou shalt not steal.
Thou shalt not bear false witness.
False witness, and one more.
Adultery.
All right, it's amazing how in a Bible Institute, we're struggling to remember the Ten Commandments when it used to be part of society that everybody knew them. And those were the days where they didn't have to have CCTV cameras and biometric access to places and tiger thefts. Those were better days when the Ten Commandments ruled. Amen. All right, write the first five books of the Pentateuch in order. Nita, what's the first one?
Genesis.
Next one?
Exodus.
Next? Wrong. Sorry. What's the next? Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Paul?
Numbers.
Deuteronomy. Okay, Deuteronomy's the last one. What is the theme of the book of Exodus, Nita?
Exiting out of Egypt.
All right, it's actually deliverance from Egypt. It is exit, but it's deliverance from Egypt, deliverance from sin. Who was the book of Leviticus written for, Barry?
The priests.
The priests of the tribe of Levi, yes, number 17. Deuteronomy was written for what people? Now, not just the Jews, but which ones in particular?
New generation of Jews.
New generation of Jews that had been children when they came out of Egypt, and their parents had all died, and now this new generation got a second chance at hearing the law. 18, try and list the 10 plagues. So if you got that, amen, we actually won't go through that, just take. Trying to remember the plagues, that's pretty hard to do. I would be pretty impressed if you got all 10. Pretty impressed indeed. Okay, we need to move to Joshua, Judges, and Ruth. We are now entering the 12 history books of the Old Testament. That includes Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. There is history in almost all the books of the Bible, but these are distinctly historical and cover the history of Israel from their arrival to the Promised Land unto their demise and defeat at the hands of the Assyrians. Now remember, northern Israel is conquered by the Assyrian Empire, but southern Israel, which is Judah and Benjamin, they don't fall for a couple hundred years later because they do, on occasion, get right with God. But they ultimately get conquered by the Babylonian Empire. Now that's a way to end a history lesson. If you're studying history and you see your people being defeated, it's pretty discouraging. But it doesn't end there. It actually, the history books also include three more books, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. And Ezra and Nehemiah in particular describe Israel coming back into the land. But that's where it ends. In the Hebrew Bible, the history ends with them back in the land and waiting. And they don't know what for. As far as the modern Israel, back then, they were waiting for the Messiah. I was talking to somebody last night about the book of Daniel, and the Jews do not consider Daniel a prophet anymore. They have relegated him to just to history, which is an amazing thing. But that's because Daniel is so clear about the coming of the Messiah. When in the readings in the Jewish synagogue, when they come through Isaiah and they come and they read Isaiah 51, 52, 54, 55, 56, they skip 53. And nobody knows any better because everybody's just listening to the man at the front and never having their own Bibles. And they skip Isaiah 53 because they don't want to allow that anybody might connect that Jesus was the suffering Messiah. All right, now the book of Joshua. This book serves as the connecting link between the five books of the Pentateuch and the latter historical books. Its name is derived from its principal character, Joshua. Most of the chapters describe the conquest of the land and its division among the tribes of Israel. In the final chapters, Joshua exhorts the people to keep and to do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses. And he earnestly challenges them to maintain their covenant commitment with God. When did they make a covenant commitment with God?
When they crossed the Jordan.
No, they had not, the Red Sea, because they hadn't crossed Jordan. Israel does cross over. The covenant commitment with God was first, as far as God was concerned, it was with the Passover. Every covenant was established with blood. Jesus said, "This is the New Testament, the New Covenant in my blood." So it was at the Passover that the covenant was offered, and Israel accepted, but they made the final commitment at Mount Sinai. There they said, "All right, this is our God. We are now going to follow and be His people." So at Mount Sinai was the birth of a nation. Okay.
That's when Moses came down with the Ten Commandments.
That's right. That's right. more than likely, the author is written by him by himself, by Joshua. But the problem is he dies at the end, and it seems like somebody came along and wrote some extra things. So probably that was written by Samuel. But anyway, one note I want you to understand. Joshua is the same name as Jesus in Greek. So they both mean Jehovah saves. So Joshua, there's actually three times in the Bible, Jesus and Joshua and Hosea come through. They all of the three ways of saying what we call as Jesus. Hosea was about 1,000 years later, so things had changed in the way they pronounced things. So Hosea, the book of Hosea, was written by a prophet with the very same name as Joshua, which if you met him in Greek, it would have been Jesus. So Joshua and Jesus have an incredible number of similarities. No, there are three times in the Bible where somebody has an important name, Joshua, Hosea, and Jesus, and they're all three the same name, just at three different time periods. First one, Joshua, 1400 BC, Hosea, about 500 BC, and then Jesus, 1 AD. Okay, but they're all three. As a matter of fact, if you take your Bible and turn to Acts chapter 1, I'll show you this. Acts chapter 7. Here we are. Verse 44, Acts 7:44. Our fathers had the tabernacle of witness in the wilderness, as he had appointed, speaking unto Moses that he should make it according to the fashion that he had seen. which also our fathers that came after brought in with Jesus into the possession of the Gentiles, whom God drave out before the face of our fathers unto the days of David. So they brought in with Jesus, but Jesus is the Greek way of saying Joshua. All right, so it's just so that you know that it's all the same name, three different people. Okay, Acts 7:44. Okay, date of writing. This book was written around 1400 B.C. 1400. The purpose? 44 and 45 is what I was reading. The purpose of writing. Why was this book written? It was to provide an overview of the military battles to conquer the land that God had promised to Abraham and his sons through Isaac. Now, that's a great truth. God had promised, this is your land, but you've got to fight for it. And God has given you a new life as a Christian. He's given you eternal life, which is a free gift. But the life as a Christian in this world, in this flesh, has to be conquered. Okay? So, at the beginning of the book of Joshua, the new nation is now ready to enter the promised land, conquer the inhabitants, and occupy the territory. The book itself gives only selected details of many of the battles and manners in which the land was not only conquered, but how it was divided into its tribal areas. Now, key scripture, sorry.
What did you say about relating this to...
Well, when God made a promise that this is the land that I've got for you, it was a shadow, it was a type, not of heaven, like some people might like to wish that a Christian has been promised heaven. Yes, we have. But the promised land was a new life. And every believer, as soon as we get saved, we think our battles are over many times. But no, the battles have just begun. Because you are now occupying, in this flesh, you are occupying enemy territory. Your flesh does not want to serve God. Your flesh does not want to do right. So you're going to have to battle to conquer it. And it is a constant battle. It took Joshua well over 25 years to conquer the entire land. If you've only been saved 5 years, well, you're doing pretty good compared to Joshua. The encouragement is that there is a battle, and the battle sometimes takes a while to complete. Key scriptures. Let's go to Joshua 1. The two key scriptures for the book of Joshua are, first of all, to start well, and secondly, to fill in, to stay faithful. Start well and stay faithful. I promise you didn't.
Honey, what was the date of the writing?
1400. Joshua 1:6. John Kennedy, if you'll read down to verse 9.
Be strong and of good courage. For unto this people shall tell to void for an inheritance the land, which I swear unto their fathers to give them. Only be thou strong and very courageous, that thou mayest observe to do according to all the law, which Moses my servant commanded thee. Turn not from it to the right hand or to the left, that thou mayest prosper whithersoever thou goest. This book of the law shall not depart out of thy mouth, for thou shalt meditate therein day and night, that thou mayest observe to do according to all that is written therein. For then thou shalt make thy way prosperous, and then thou shalt have good success. Have not I commanded thee, be strong and of good courage, be not afraid, neither be thou dismayed, for the Lord thy God is with thee wheresoever thou goest.
Amen. All right, start well. Start with a book. Start with the promises of God. Start with diligence. And start with strength. Start well. And then stay faithful. Look at Joshua 24, 14 and 15. Let's see, Paul 24, 14 and 15. Now, when it says flood here, he's talking about not the flood of Noah's day, but the flood of the Jordan River.
Therefore, fear the Lord, and serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the flood and in Egypt, and serve ye the Lord. And if it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served which were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites in whom land you dwell. But as for me and my house, he will serve the Lord.
All right. And he's well over 120, 130 years. I can't remember how old he was. And he's still saying, we're going to keep serving the Lord, so stay faithful. Okay, those are key scriptures of the book of Joshua. Now, let's just briefly run through an outline of the book of Joshua. Chapter 1 provides the commissioning of Joshua and the Lord's instruction and encouragement to him to begin his leadership. Chapter 2, you have two spies who enter in Moses. Joshua had learned from Moses that you don't send 12 spies in, you only need to send 2 in. Because there's too much potential for people to disagree and to discourage the people. So 2 spies enter into Jericho and they're hidden by Rahab the harlot. chapter 3 and 4. You know, it's a funny thing. The kind of people that gathered around Jesus were harlots and sinners. There's just something about what the world considers as throwaway, as, oh, they're too far gone. And yet, when Jesus got around them, they were the ones that really stuck closest to the Lord. And this is a woman who really believed God. And she affected her family and brought them to God. Chapters 3 and 4 is the crossing of the Jordan River now on dry land. What Moses could do, Joshua was able to do. It's a miracle reminiscent of the early parting of the Red Sea when the ancestors of this generation, the Israelites, had experienced. So it must have been something for those kids to have watched, but then it was a distant 40-year-old memory, and here it was happening again. On the other side, they established a memorial to remind the future generations of the miracle of God and of His provision, and that there was no turning back. Okay? Chapter 5, male circumcision was reestablished. It had been 40 years since children had been circumcised. It's a sign gift. And the supply of manna ends one day, and God says, all right, get where busy, plant some corn, and grow your own food for the next season. At the end of the chapter, the Lord appears to Joshua with further instructions on how to conquer the land, and it was always going to be at his leadership, not Joshua's leadership. Chapter 6 is the fall of Jericho. They march around 7 times, or 6 days, they march around, and then on the 7th day, they march around 7 times. And then all they do is shout. And two rows of walls, dozens of feet thick, across both of them, maybe 20 feet thick, completely collapse, straight down. Chapter 7, sin is in the camp. In the city of Jericho belonged to God. Everything that was in that city was the first fruits of the land. It was the tithe that would belong to God. Everything else in the nation of the promised land and among all those people were going to be for the people. But this first city belonged to God. So everything that they found that was of value was going to be given to God. But this one man says, I can't wait. I know there are more cities, but I want this wedge of gold. I want that beautiful looking outfit. And he takes it and he hides it. He thinks it won't matter. But that one sin of disobedience costs 32 people, 36 people at Ai, costs them their lives and costs embarrassment to the entire nation of Israel. They couldn't go forward until they dealt with sin in their camp. And it was by a man named, what was his name?
Achan.
Achan.
A-C-H-A-N.
Thank you. Chapter 8, they turn around and they say, all right, we dealt with sin, we dealt with what was inside, now let's go back after our enemy, and they defeat Ai, and they are back on track. Chapter 9, you've got some guys called the Gibeonites who show up and they put on a ruse. They act like they've traveled for months when they've only traveled for about 2 weeks, maybe less than a week they had traveled down, and they were part of the inhabitants, and God had said, slaughter every man, woman, and child. Don't allow any of them left over because they were so vile. We're talking about they have unearthed the engravings and the pictures and the stories of life in Canaan land before Israel went in and conquered it. And it is as pornographic as it is as bad as the internet could ever be. What they did to children, what they did to animals, and what they did to themselves, and the filth. And God said, there is no hope or chance for these people. Wipe them out. They are under the judgment of God. So, but these people come, and Joshua forgets to pray, and he believes the deception of the Gibeonites. Yes.
When was that unearthed?
Oh, that's over the last 200 years.
Hmm.
He found all sorts of skills.
Any resources?
Well, my goodness, all you have to do is get on the internet and look up Canaanites. And it is.
How come they never put this thing out in the news? You know?
Oh, because the news doesn't want to let it on that everything works in cycles, and we're back at the cycle where God needs to judge us. Now, chapter 10. more victories where the Lord throws his enemies into confusion. It's also the this is the chapter where they're fighting against insurmountable odds, and Joshua is. He has to defend the Gibeonites. Once he makes a promise to protect them and then finds out that he's lied to them, he still can't go back on his promise. So when they're being attacked for befriending Israel, I mean, these guys were supposed to be anti-Israel, but now they're the friends of Israel. So all the other nations come and they surround the Gibeonites and attack them. And Joshua's overwhelmed. He was attacking one small kingdom at a time, but now he's attacking and dealing with five at a time. The battle goes on and rages through the day, and it comes to the night, and the sun's getting ready to set, and Joshua, without any hesitation, says, hold it right there. Don't set. I want to finish this battle. And the sun doesn't move for 24 hours. The moon's coming up over, over in the east, and they just sit there for 24 hours. So it's an incredible miracle that God just said, okay, and listen to the prayer of a man. It's the only time that it has ever happened. The thing that's closest is Hezekiah asking for the sun shadow to move back just about 40 minutes. You know, almost an hour. I'd just like to see it move backwards. And it did. I mean, he could have asked. I'd like to see it go all the way around once. But he only asked for 1 hour. Sorry, Anita. I thought you put your hand up.
would that have meant the earth was around the sun?
Yeah. Yes. But it's all by perspective. If I'm sitting here and the sun doesn't move, I would say, the sun's not moving, even though it's the earth, by perspective. Yes. Okay. you know, if you were a fly in a car, right, buzzing around, and all these trees are, you'd say, man, those trees are moving fast. But you wouldn't understand that the car was moving, but the tree is passing by. You understand? Mm-hmm. All right. Chapters 11 and 12, more battles. 13 through 19, all of a sudden they start to make some progress. A lot of the battles are behind them, and so they start saying, all right, this area is peaceful, this area is quiet. Ephraim, you go here. Judah, you're there. Benjamin, you're over here. And they begin to allocate the land to the different tribes. But it also ends up time after time where there was like, they had some mopping up battles to do, and there would be some small pockets of guerrilla warfare going on, and the tribes would go in, and they would let them live over in a little corner of a field, or not a field, but in out in the countryside, they just let them go on. It'd be like Ireland having a bunch of pockets of redhead defenders still living down in Bandon and over here and over there. Some of them were McCroom and stuff. And it's like, let them be let on. And it would only mean disaster in the future. Okay? So there was a tolerance toward these other pagan cultures living among them. Chapter 20, you have the establishment of the cities of refuge. Mm-hmm. Very important. The cities of refuge was for if there was any kind of accidents, accidental deaths, you could go to those cities of refuge and you would have a place of protection until evidence would prove that you were innocent or until the death of the high priest when you would be free. Chapter 21 goes on with more division of the land. 22 a near disaster is averted through Galilee. I wrote this weeks ago and I don't remember what chapter 22 is about. Give me a second. Why did I summarize it that way? Joshua 22 is... Oh. the disaster is... When they're splitting up, we didn't really touch on it last week, but there were 2.5 tribes that did not want to go into the promised land. Gad, Manasseh, half the tribe of Manasseh, and who was the other one? My brain is not working. Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh was a huge tribe, and half of the tribe of Manasseh. And if you go back, if you've got your page, you'll see page 30, I think, is your page from the previous section on Exodus and Deuteronomy. You'll see a map there. Page 30. And right in the middle of the map, you'll see across from the Mediterranean Sea all the way across the Jordan River over into what was known as Jordan. It was not part of Israel, but Manasseh wanted to, half of them wanted to stay out of the Promised Land, the other half wanted in. It's like a lot of Christians, you know, they want to be in church, but they don't want to be totally committed. You also got the tribe of Gad just south of it, and then Reuben down by the Red Sea. Those three, are outside of the Promised Land. Now, when Joshua lets them go, because they had asked Moses, can we do this? Moses says, sure, you have free will, go right ahead. So he lets them go, but only after they have fought all of the enemies in the Promised Land, then they go back. Now, as they're going, they set up a huge altar. And when they do, they didn't tell anybody what it was for or whatever, and the Israelites inside the Promised Land see them building this massive stone structure, and they think it's an idol. And they prepare for war, and they are determined that we are not going to have any idols. And they're about ready to slaughter Manasseh, Dan, and Reuben. They are very intent. And it was a near disaster, but then they stop them and they says, no, this is a reminder to us that we belong to you, that we are part of the same family, that we are all Israelites. And so, and they called that huge pile of rocks. It was a very well put together altar, and it was just called Ed. So Ed means a witness. So when somebody calls, you know, is used when they have the name Ed, it is a biblical term. It means a witness. So in your disaster, chapter 23 and 24, at the age of 110, Joshua goes through how faithful God was. And reminds them that they need to stay close to God. Now, some practical applications. Joshua is a great example of the result of effective discipleship. For years, Joshua had followed Moses very closely. He watched Moses as he followed God in an almost flawless manner. He learned from Moses how to truly pray. He learned how to obey through the example of Moses. Joshua also learned from Moses' sin of anger. And the cost of it. So you can learn from the bad things of somebody as well. The truth is, as long as you're alive, you are a mentor, a teacher. Someone somewhere is always watching you, Jeremy. I'm watching you. Some younger person or someone that you are influencing is seeing how you live and how you react to life's problems. Someone is learning from you. Someone will follow your example, no matter how good or bad. Discipleship, mentoring, is far more than the words that are spoken by the mentor. His or her entire life is on display for all to see. How do you measure up? How worthy are you to be a person worth imitating? How carefully and fearfully are you living with the awesome privilege and responsibility of being watched? Joshua was able to effectively lead Israel because he himself had been a good follower at first. All of his life had prepared him for this challenge. And what is God preparing you for? So, the principle is, Joshua was such a good leader because he was a very good follower at first. That's what makes a great discipler. He's somebody who's a good student first. And so, the book of Joshua is a great application in discipleship. And the people of Israel followed Joshua just as well as they followed Moses because Joshua had followed Moses. It was easy to follow a good follower. It's easy to follow a leader who's a good follower. Now, judges, any questions also? Obviously, any questions? We're rapidly going through.
Who did the 2.5 tribes provoke when they built the altar?
No, they provoked all of Israel. Israel saw them building this stone, and they didn't know it was going to be just a witness.
The rest
of the tribes were ready to slaughter them. Judges, this book is named after the people called the Judges of Israel. They are the heroic leaders. On the next page. These are the heroic leaders whose deeds it records. This book covers a period of time from the death of Joshua to the birth of Samuel. It's an era called the Dark Ages in Hebrew history. On the human side, it is a story of disobedience and disaster, but on the divine side, it's a story of direction and deliverance. Of the 13 judges named, only 3 are well known: Deborah, Gideon, and Samson. Deborah, Gideon, and Samson. The book of the Judges covers almost 400 years of history. God works, underline that word, that number, and remember this: God works in 400 years for some reason. I'll give an example. In bits and pieces of 400 years, from the giving of the law until David, or until Solomon, and the raising of the permanent temple is 400 years. The children of Israel were in Egypt 430 years, just around 400 years. From Malachi until the coming of the Messiah, John the Baptist preaching, was 400 years of silence. There are sets of 400 years. It was kind of unique. Since the time of the printing of the King James Bible, it's been almost 400 years. And I think we're coming close to the end. Amen. Well, it's an unusual connection. Whether it's true or not, we will soon find out.
What was the one about Malachi?
Malachi to John the Baptist was 400 years, the announcing of the arrival of the Messiah. God had been silent for 400 years as far as the prophets were concerned. There are several other 400-year spots, but it was just kind of cute. The author. The book of Judges doesn't specifically name its author. Most people believe it was the prophet Samuel, which I would agree with. Internal evidence that that the author of Judges lived shortly after the period of Judges, and Samuel fits his qualification. When it was written, probably just put 1000 BC. I would say 1100, but there's all sorts of. But say 1000 BC, the date of the writing.
I was just thinking, isn't that amazing that Moses, you know, you were saying that, you know, those were 400 years, but the children of Israel in Egypt was 430 years, and Moses got out of God's will and killed that man and was gone for 40 years, you know, so if you were to subtract.
No, 40 years in the wilderness.
Yeah.
And they were 40 years in the wilderness, yeah.
You know, just to know that God could have used him a lot sooner, but God mm-hmm. still ended up using him.
Oh, yeah, that's the blessing. The purpose of writing is to provide a historical account of the struggles of the Jews against their enemies, both from within and without. They had trouble following God, and ultimately will demand a king to lead them instead of God. They just had a problem with following God. And this is true. If I were to disappear in the morning, how many of you would stay faithful in church? How many would stay faithful in being busy with soul winning and with being taking up leadership positions? We need leaders, don't we? But in the days of the judges, it is extremely evident how desperate their need was for leaders. So they demand a king. And until a king finally reigned, Israel would have to learn how to just how quickly they would fall into sin and how much they needed godly leadership. I mean, it would take days after a king would die, a judge would die, and then they would just get into some idolatry or some sin. You can look up the key verse, Judges chapter 2, talking about every man doing that which was right in his own eyes. A brief summary of the book of Judges. The book of Judges is an account of how God was taken for granted by his people year after year, century after century. Yet God has never failed to help his people whenever they repented from their wicked ways and called upon his name. And you'll see over and over in the book of Judges that they would cry out in their tribulation, when they would go through a deep valley of trouble, and then they would cry out to God, and then God would just help them. Through the 15 judges, or a total of 15, through the 15 judges of Israel, God honored his promise to Abram to protect and bless his offspring, to always protect them. After the death of Joshua and his contemporaries, the Israelites returned to serving Baal and a sex goddess called Ashtaroth. God, seeing this, allowed the Israelites to be controlled by those to whom they worshipped. Now, underline those words. God, seeing this, allowed the Israelites to be controlled by those whom they worshipped. You are a servant to whom you obey. Whether sin unto death or righteousness unto life, you've got to see that people, when they don't worship God, when they don't know anything, what they worship enslaves them. It was then that the people of God would cry out for, he's not actually always Jehovah, but God sent his children, judges, to lead them in righteous living. But time after time, they would turn their back to God and return to the lives of wickedness. However, keeping with his part of the covenant with Abram, God would send his people, save his people from their oppressors throughout the 480-year span of the book of Judges. Now, it's actually a little over 400. 480 takes you all the way up to King Saul and King David. Probably the most notable judge is the 12th judge named Samson, who came to lead the Israelites after a 40-year captivity. And under the rule of the ruthless Philistines, Samson led God's people to victory over the Philistines, where he lost his own life after 20 years as judge of Israel. So he's probably the most notable judge. If you just think of one of the judges, it's usually going to be Samson. A practical application. The life of a believer is not intended to be a life of failures, judgments, and restorations, even though that's what Judges was all about. Yes, we all fail. Yes, we all need restoration and renewal from God. But no, the book of Judges should not be a description of our daily walk with Christ. So if you could see, the book of Judges is one of these. This is what, on a spiritual scale, this is what was happening through the book of Judges for over 400 years. Okay. Now I give you an outline, an extended outline of the book of Judges. You have the first series of Judges, some of these names. You've got Othniel, Ehud. Now Ehud is amazing. He goes after a king of the Moabites. He was so fat, this king, that Ehud goes in and says, "I've got a message from God for you." And the king is like, "Oh, cool, God wants to talk to me." So he says, "Everybody out!" And so up comes Ehud. Now Ehud's a nobody, okay? So they don't really know him, but he's got a dagger with him. And he comes and he plunges the dagger into the side of the king. And when he tries to withdraw it, he's so fat, the fat just engulfs around it. He can't get it back out. So it's one of those great stories in the Bible that you they always skip over when they show those things on TV. But it was a great the Bible's just really pleasant to know that it takes great God's got a sense of humor. Then this guy named Shamgar, he fights against the Philistines. Deborah, she's the first and only female judge. She is a prophetess. But as a prophetess, she is not a leader. She calls for a general named Balak to lead God's people. Deborah heard from God, spoke for God, but was not in charge of anything. She was the state of Israel was so bad that the men were so bad that God used this woman to humble them and spiritually lead them for I don't remember how many years, but one of the keys is a lot of charismatics would say, "Well, look, Deborah was a prophetess, so we should have prophetesses today." And go, no, because when it came time to battle, Deborah didn't lead. Deborah didn't do anything except say, "Balak, you're the leader. God said you're going to win," and she just encouraged him. And there are many times when a woman can get a word from God that a man's too dense to get. But that doesn't mean that she should take over. You've got Gideon. He fights and defeats the Midianites with only 300 men. That's all. Abimelech, he's a bad leader. He's one of the judges, but he takes over through treachery. He slaughters all the a lot of the leaders and a lot of people. He's a ruthless man. He dies terribly as well. Then you got a second series of judges: Tola, J.R., Jephthah. This is a sad situation. He makes a rash vow, a very quick vow. He says, "Whatever comes out of my tent, I'll give to you, God, I'll kill it." Well, it's his daughter that comes out next. Now, he's pretty stupid. And then he keeps his vow. And it's a very sad time in Israel's history that he'd rather keep his vow than realize that he made a rash vow. Honestly, if you're going to be that particular, that if you make a promise to God, you're going to keep it, what you should do is take your own life, not take your daughter's life. But he took his daughter's life. He actually killed her. This is a time, and it says it over and over and over in the book of Judges, Everybody did that which was right in their own eyes. They had the law, but they weren't going by it. They were just doing whatever came natural. And some of these leaders weren't much better than the normal people. We've got Ibzan, Elon, Abda, and Samson. What's amazing is Samson's able to fight the Philistines single-handedly. One time with a jawbone. One time he took 300 oxes, and I don't know how you do this, but how do you tie quickly two of them together and put a firebrand, a torch, in their tails, light the torch and send them off into a field and take another set of foxes, wrap their tails together while they're not trying to bite your hands off, put a firebrand in there and send them through a field and let them burn down tens of thousands of acres. This guy was incredible.
Genius.
Yeah?
Who is this?
This is Samson.
Samson, right.
Mm. Then you got the end there. One of the things I want you got Dan migrating, trying to figure out where they were going to be in the Promised Land, and they moved both to the north and to the very south by Judah. But B is a very important thing. Benjamin nearly gets slaughtered, they wouldn't go to fight a battle, and Israel turns. This is how quickly Christians can even get. That if somebody doesn't do something that we expect, we could all pounce on them and tear them, I'm pointing to Paul right now, could just tear them apart and out of zeal. But that's incredibly wrong. The Bible's very clear that if somebody does something wrong, just break away from them. Right? Don't burn heretics, okay? Just break away from them. And let the devil at them, but don't put your hand to it. But they saw the Benjamites being rebellious, and they slaughtered almost every single Benjamite. They just were imbalanced.
Being rebellious in what way?
They just didn't want to go fight.
Oh.
And they were some of the best fighters in the entire country.
What about the story where this one gets raped by a lot of guys and then just chopped into pieces? Is that the Benjamites?
That's not the Benjamites. That is part of the problem with the Benjamites. That's part of this thing where in the Danites, you got more background. I didn't want to go into all the details of all the things because there's so much in there. But yeah, there's this Levite who has this concubine. Oh, and it's just it's a terrible relationship. And he doesn't care about her at all. And he leaves her outside and she does get abused. And she gets killed. And so he uses it to rally all the people, but the Benjamites won't fight. And so that's where the problem comes in. Okay? So it was a sad, sad time. Now, what the point is, okay, don't trust your leadership. Okay? Don't trust your leadership. Trust God. You need to follow your leadership. But what did Jesus say? He said, do what the Pharisees say, but do not do what the Pharisees do. Remember that? They sit in Moses' seat. You've got to have leaders. But you better do right from your own relationship with God. That's why we have emphasized over the last several weeks following the Lord and developing that personal walk with God. Because leadership can be a nightmare, can be a disaster. You may have a great pastor.
You do have a great pastor, I hope.
There are a lot of good things, but that can change should your spirituality be connected with your leadership? Or should your spirituality be connected with your relationship with God? You need leaders. And leaders are good because they actually are used by God to refine you, to direct you. And sometimes you think, well, they're wrong or they're not. But they're being used by God. Babylon was being used by God to direct his people and humble them and bring them back right with him. But all of these, you say, well, boy, a lot of these guys weren't that spiritual, weren't that good. No, but they were leaders. Just like King Saul was not a great spiritual leader, but he was their leader. And David said, I'm not going to fight him. Whatever he says, do. And even when Saul wants to kill him, David can't fight him. David has to run into hiding. And he's right for not fighting back. Now, there are two more judges to come, and they come up in 1 Samuel. They are Eli and Samuel. Eli and Samuel. All right, quickly, Ruth. The book of Ruth offers a striking contrast to the book of Judges. Even though they cover the same time frame, the book of Ruth occurs during the book of Judges. The stories associated with the same period in Judges, national sin and corruption portray a dark picture. The story of Ruth, the Moabitess, M-O-A-B-I-T-E-S-S, Moabitess. And the story of Ruth the Moabitess, that was a nation cursed by God, and her loyalty and devotion to Naomi, her Hebrew mother-in-law, presents the reader with a picture of the better side of Hebrew life in the days of the Judges. It wasn't totally bad. And pictures the redemption of this world by Jesus the Redeemer. So the author, the book of Ruth, was probably written by Samuel. Date of writing, around 1000 B.C. You know, some of these dates are kind of hard to pin down. The purpose of writing was written to the Israelites to teach them that genuine love at times may require uncompromising sacrifice. Regardless of our lot in life, we can live according to the precepts, the commands of God. Genuine love and kindness will always be rewarded. God abundantly blesses those who seek to live obedient lives. And obedient living does not allow for accidents in God's plan. God extends mercy to the merciful. Ruth, Naomi, all of the people in this book could have gotten, and Naomi really does get bitter, but they could have stayed bitter and they could have stayed mad at God because of the circumstances, but instead they saw it as the plan of God. And let me go through, you got three key verses that you can look them up later, but let me go through the brief summary and then explain something here. The setting of the book of Ruth begins in the heathen country of Moab, a region northeast of the Dead Sea, but then moves to Bethlehem. The story moves back to Bethlehem. This true account takes place during the dismal days of failure and rebellion of the Israelites called the period of the Judges. A famine forces Elimelech and his wife Naomi from their Israelite home to the country of Moab. So it's a famine that drives them out. Elimelech dies, and Naomi is left with her two sons, who soon marry, not two Jewish girls, not two the right kind of girls, but two pagan Moabite girls, Orpah and Ruth. Neither one of them know God. Later, both of the sons die. Look at the high cost of being out of the will of God. And Naomi is left alone with Orpah and Ruth in a strange land. Orpah returns to her parents. She has no problem with going back. But Ruth determines to stay with Naomi as they journey back to Bethlehem. Naomi says, there's nothing more for me here. I'm going home. And Ruth says, I'm going with you. Your God will be my God. This story of love and devotion tells of Ruth's eventual marriage to a wealthy man named Boaz, by whom she bears a son, Obed, who becomes the grandfather of David and the ancestor of Jesus. Obedience brings Ruth into the privileged lineage of Christ.
Well, Christ is actually descended from Moabite blood rather than born evil.
That's right. Yeah. His man side has got all of the mess of Adam's sin. Okay? There's a lot more to it. I mean, you think about it. Solomon is a relationship. He's born to David and Bathsheba. And Bathsheba was another man's wife. Mm-hmm. So, Solomon, what were you going to say?
Oh, I thought he said rather than Hebrew.
Rather than pure Hebrew blood.
Some
people are a purist when they come to religion, and they think if there's any flaw in God's plan, then God is flawed. And that's not true. There's flaw in us, but God always uses disaster for his purpose.
Is that part of why the Jews didn't accept Jesus?
No. Because they themselves...
Didn't come into it at all?
No, not at all. There's none. As a matter of fact, this is funny.
What did he ask?
Is that one of the reasons why the Jews did not accept Jesus? Right? No, Jesus was just as much a Jew as everybody else. Okay, because if that's true, then David was the great grandson of Ruth. So David was not of pure Israeli blood. Sorry.
And so you have to be the son of David.
Has to be the son of David. That's it. Okay. Then have your pure blood. Talking about no spot or blemish in their history, no skeletons in their closet. Practical application. Let's go to Matthew 1:5, and I'll go show you something here. Matthew chapter 1 and verse 5.
Hmm.
Mm. Right, you've got the genealogy, the family history of Jesus, and it goes in verse 5, and Salmon begat Boaz of Rahab. That's Rahab or Rahab. And Boaz begat Obed of Ruth, and Obed begat Jesse, and Jesse begat David. You got two women there, Rahab the harlot and Ruth the Moabitess. And God's able to keep things on course. That's pretty cool. Alright. You find in Matthew 1:5, you'll find that Boaz is the son of the prostitute Rahab. Boaz? Boaz's mommy was Rahab the harlot. Yeah.
Have that written down. Where is that?
Right in Practical Application.
Oh, okay.
Ruth was a despised foreigner married to the son of a prostitute. But she was also the ancestor of Jesus Christ. These kinds of things happen in the Bible, and we should be blessed that they do. We have a master weaver that has a place in his plan for each of us. Isn't that cool? So what looks like a disaster to Naomi going home with nothing is actually, yeah, it's probably the devil's work to try and destroy everybody's life, but God takes those pieces and makes something beautiful so that everybody looks and goes, wow, that's awesome. Four chapters in the book of Ruth. Chapter 1 is a bitter journey. Chapter 2, Ruth gets to meet Boaz. Chapter 3, Naomi, the matchmaker. And I think all women are designed to be matchmakers. Naomi helps Ruth in getting Boaz as her husband. And he's the redeemer, which means this. Naomi owes a lot of money. She has a ton of back taxes. She has a lot of debt. And Ruth, Naomi can't work. The only way to save the farm, so to speak, is if Ruth had somebody pay off that debt and would take over the name of Naomi's family. Again, it's understanding that when Ruth married Naomi's son, it was the father's name passing through the son to the children, and there were no children. And so, who's going to inherit the land, and who's going to pay off the debt of the land? Who would want to do that? I mean, you might get land, but there was more debt on the land than there was money to get out of the land. So everybody would stay far away from this prospect of this family that was heavily in debt. But Boaz, who is what's called a near kinsman, he could carry on the name of Ruth's husband. And he gladly, now he ultimately says, there's one who's closer in kin than I am who should marry you. And he goes up to him and he says, there's a piece of property if you want to buy. It's got some debt on it, but it'll be yours. Do you want it? He says, yep, I want it. I want all the land I can get. He says, yeah, but you've also got to take Ruth with it. He goes, Ruth is a Moabite. I don't want her. No, you take it. And Boaz gladly says, yep, I'll take responsibility. But also his heart was in love with Ruth. Now the picture of this is, write this down, this is the picture of Jesus looking at us, at the church. This is a great typology of Jesus redeeming worthless aliens, sinners, and paying off our debt. So one of the things that we'll end up this survey with, we'll go back and we'll see where Jesus is all throughout the Old Testament.
So who does the Goliath actually get this represent? If Boaz represents Jesus, is it?
Yeah, I don't know. I never thought about that. But that would be every religion. Every religion only takes advantage of people. Only does things for advantage, whereas Jesus does things out of giving. I mean, what religion isn't wealthy?
Books.
You know, you got to understand, all of their religion, I mean, maybe an individual may be poor, but the religion, the golden Buddhas, the Tibetan monks live in some of the most opulent places on rice, but they live in incredible opulence. So what religion isn't wealthy? All religions except Christianity. Freely you received, freely give. And so he's probably a type of religion that says, I can't. The only reason why we'd want poor is to make money off of them.
So was he breaking a commandment by marrying Ruth Greene? You weren't allowed to do that, were you?
No. To the 10th generation, you weren't allowed to marry a Moabitess until after 10 generations of the Moabites. God had made that clear to Moses, and she was the 11th generation. It's pretty amazing. Okay. Any questions?
And why did Shimon Ben Gad kept punishing sin while they're in the wilderness? He was really strict on it. But then, so soon after they got into the promised land, why did he just say, no, you can do anything you want, that's right in your own hands?
It's called dispensational. All right.
What
it means. All right, his question is, why was God so strict in the wilderness and not so strict in the promised land? It's a great question, and it shows that you've got to grow up. When you're a baby, you're supposed to be strict with discipline. You're supposed to be strict with times to go to bed, times to get up. But as they get older, you got to let that off, and they've got to suffer their own consequences. Okay. All right. Any other questions?
What was that you said? You weren't allowed to marry who until the 10th generation?
Anybody of the Moabites.
Oh.